Hello, this is Mark Peacock, and welcome to the Travel Commons Podcast. This is Travel Commons Podcast number 92, recorded Friday, August 5th, 2011. This is the podcast giving the voice of the traveler. It's more about the journey than the destination. Two topics on this edition of the Travel Commons Podcast: the not-so-upbeat traveler and travel tech. iPad 2 versus Samsung Galaxy Android tablet. So my travel since the last podcast has been pretty evenly split between personal and business travel. So the first couple of weeks was summer vacation in the UK, the Lake District, Scotland, a couple days in London. We had absolutely phenomenal weather. I mean, the whole time we were there, one afternoon of rain, and the rest of the time it was warm and sunny. Yeah, I'll tell you, almost too warm for the clothes we packed. And everyone who lived there was amazed. I mean, you know, all the bed and breakfast owners were just marveling at the weather. "It's lovely," said our landlady in Edinburgh. She said last week it was hailing. So lucky us, because I'll tell you, we didn't pack for hail. And just to make sure that I didn't forget that we were on vacation, we stayed in bed and breakfast the whole time. Until we hit London, when I made the reservations. And actually, when I think about it, you know, the service that we get from the bed and breakfasts really isn't all that different from what I get in the concierge lounges at big hotels. I mean, you know, breakfast comes with the room, though I'll tell you, the full cooked breakfast at the bed and breakfasts, sort of, you know, complete with black pudding in England and haggis in Scotland, I'll tell you, that was a little heartier than the continental breakfast I normally get in concierge lounge. And there was a nice chit-chat when you walk in, though, you know, the bed and breakfast owners were typically a bit older or more seasoned than the typical lounge staff. I mean, I guess the main differences were that most of the hotels I stay in don't have dogs living there, and they prefer credit cards over cash. Now, of course, back in the U.S., the weather had been just sort of sweltering. I mean, I was in South Florida a couple of weeks ago, and it was actually cooler there than in Chicago. But that just wasn't good enough. So last week, I was down in Phoenix, where it was hitting 105, 107 degrees during the day and wasn't getting below 100, you know, degrees any time while I was awake. Tough weather to take advantage of the convertible red Mustang that Avis was nice enough to upgrade me to. Wednesday night after dinner, though, while I was in Phoenix, I decided I had to drop the top on that Mustang. Now, the dashboard said the external temperature was 102, and I felt every degree of it when I dropped that top. Soon, though, I found that the key to driving top down in 102-degree weather is pretty much the same as driving top down in 55-degree weather. You know, set the fan to high, and, you know, the only difference is you got to remember to set the knob to air condition, not to heat. So following up, let's take a run through the comment bag. You know, Sarah, who's been a listener since 2006, posted a comment on the website on episode number 85, going way back. She says, "I've been playing catch up after all my driving trips this past 2 months." Okay, so that explains going all the way back to episode 85. Anyhow, in that episode, I talked about how the hotel industry seems to be focused on spiffing up their lobbies and sort of putting whizzy new technology in the rooms, and that I thought they were making a mistake ignoring what I think is the critical hotel experience, which is the bathroom. Sarah says, "I say, heck yeah to the bathroom being one of the most important parts of the stay. I ended up in a bed and breakfast in the middle of nowhere with no Wi-Fi, and the bathroom made me want to tell everybody about it. It had a hot tub and a beautifully large bathroom, but even though I knew no one was going to be in the area, I wanted to tell everybody about it. It's the Inn in New Berlin, Pennsylvania, in case you care." Well, Sarah, thanks for that note, and thanks for the pointer to the Inn in New Berlin. I do think that we look for luxurious touches in hotels, and it doesn't have to be anything big. The first thing my wife looks for in a hotel room is to see if there are robes in the bathroom. I mean, that to her is, you know, that's a set point. Robes, good sign. I mean, I'll tell you, and I think it's a hell of a lot cheaper to put a robe in a bathroom than installing a tricked out media panel. And at least with folks like my wife, it makes a much bigger impression. Now, Sarah's comment about wanting to tell everyone about her find reminded me of some stats I saw a few days ago. It said, on average, 24% of hotel guests first heard about the hotel from a friend or family member, and 16% from a review site like TripAdvisor. So I would guess that if anyone could calculate the cost of creating an enthusiastic recommender like Sarah, if you did that calculus, I bet it'd turn out to be a lot cheaper to do it with a great bathroom than a posh new lobby. Now, fast forwarding to episode number 90, Andrew Gill left a comment on the Travel Commons Facebook wall. Andrew writes, "Thanks for podcast number 90. It's great to hear how 170-degree recline isn't as comfortable as fully flat, especially when my company has taken a different approach to travel, UK to Australia in economy, just has to be tried. You talked about using large chunks of roaming data on a recent trip, and I've got a couple of hints to share. Google Maps is great, but try City Maps to Go. I've been using it for over a year, having tried other offline mapping products. It uses the built-in compass, so I don't have to walk a block either way to figure out if I'm going in the right direction. I've also become a real convert to local SIM cards. Now, this may not be perfect for a business trip, but I had 2 weeks in Chile in January, and my iPhone bill was $500. Compare this to 2 weeks in Australia using the $2 Australian a day plan from Optus, and my bill was $22. In Australia, I didn't worry about when I used my phone or finding the next hotspot because I had unlimited calls, SMS, and internet usage, all for $2 Australian a day." Well, Andrew, thanks for that. Hey, sorry about whinging about a 10% seat recline. I mean, I paid for that on my flight over to Manchester last month, 8 hours of suffering in coach in a packed American Airlines 757. I mean, even United gives you free beer in coach going over the Atlantic, but not American. But more importantly, thanks for the tip on City Maps to Go. I looked at it for our UK vacation, but since we were spending most of our time sort of in the hinterlands, the Lake District, the Isle of Arran around Loch Lomond, it wasn't going to give us enough coverage. I found though a great app from Phil Endicott called UK Map. And you know, there you go, truth in advertising. For $11, you get all the Ordnance Survey maps, 2D and 3D views, combined with OpenStreetMap.org info, and it's all downloaded to your device so you can use it offline. It's a universal map, so I have it on both my iPhone and my iPad. I'll tell you, if you're touring the UK, I highly recommend it. Now, I may end up back in Madrid in a couple of months, and if I do, though, for there, I'll be downloading its maps from City Maps to Go. I did find an unexpected but valuable benefit for my Starbucks obsession. I have a couple of Starbucks gift cards that I've registered. I kind of did it on a whim. They send me a card for a free drink every 15 coffees I buy. Actually, I don't use the cards. I mean, they'd be wasted on me ordering a tall coffee or a tall cappuccino. I give them to my kids who use them to, you know, buy these venti frappuccino things. But anyway, while in London, I found that my U.S. Starbucks reward credentials gave me free Wi-Fi access in UK Starbucks. And since I was limiting my mobile data usage, and there seems to be like a Starbucks every 200 feet in London, it was very handy. You know, and speaking of Starbucks, when I was flying out of O'Hare last week, one of the Starbucks in Terminal 3 advertised Trenta is here, well, which is, you know, Starbucks' new sort of big gulp serving size. I thought about this while I was waiting in line to order my tall, bold coffee. You know, should somebody really be selling the Trenta size in airports? I mean, does it make sense to sell someone 31 fluid ounces of a beverage right before they're going to be strapped into a seat for the next 2 to 4 hours? I mean, and the odds are that that person, you know, the person ordering a Trenta will be in the window seat, meaning that, you know, he or she's rousting two people at least 2 to 3 times a flight to drain that Trenta. And then, you know, reacting to my comments about Ryanair in the last episode, Leo Vigoda wrote, "What you say about Ryanair reminds me of how Irish comedian Andrew Maxwell described them. He said, Ryanair is what flying would be like if it was illegal. I think that says it all." I'll tell you, Leo, I think that is perfect, and I think it perfectly describes Ryanair and Spirit and all that ilk. You know, it shouldn't be too surprising then that four of the top eight most hated companies in America are airlines. I mean, the latest American Customer Satisfaction Index has American Airlines at number eight, United at number seven, US Airways at number six, and Delta at number two. And they beat out Potomac Electric Utility for the number one spot just by 2 points. I mean, sort of impressive finish all around. So if you've got a question, a story, a comment, a travel tip, the voice of the traveler, send it along. The email address is comments, COMMENTS, at travelcommons.com. Use the Voice Memo app on your iPhone or something like Virtual Recorder on your Android phone to record and send in an audio comment. You can always send a Twitter message to M. Peacock. You can post your thoughts on the Travel Commons Facebook page like Andrew did, or you can always go old school and post your thoughts on the website at travelcommons.com. So the first topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is the not-so-upbeat traveler. Now, you know, this podcast is a hobby, not a business for me, as if you couldn't tell from the sort of haphazard posting schedule. So I don't obsess over podcast or website stats, you know, sort of how many downloads, how many page views, sort of all the stuff that real live web businesses live and breathe and monitor on a regular real-time basis. I do, though, sort of check in every couple of days to make sure everything's running, you know, sort of clean the spam bin and look at the site stats to see actually if anybody's still coming by. I didn't do this while I was on vacation at the beginning of, at the end of June, beginning of July, but when I got back and checked in, I saw that I had gotten flooded with visits the first week in July. So clicking back and following the source links, I found that most of the traffic came from StumbleUpon, while another bit came from a recent post by Chris Christensen on his Amateur Traveler blog. So the StumbleUpon pointer was from somebody, Sherlock, who described herself just as a woman from Ontario. Now, she very nicely recommended episode number 88, where I reported from the floor of the Travel Goods show here in Chicago, and then also talked about losing elite status. So Sherlock, if that's her name, you know, her comment was, a neat travel site, not as upbeat as some, which actually lined up very nicely with Chris's post titled, Where is the Darker Side of Travel? Chris was responding to a listener's letter that suggested his Amateur Traveler podcast sugarcoats the travel experience a bit. The listener challenged Chris to bring attention to the darker side of travel. Chris gave what I thought was a good straight-up response that boiled down to, guilty as charged, I'm an optimistic guy, and if you want a podcast about travel from the point of view of how bad it can be, listen to Mark Peacock's Travel Commons. Mark is a friend and fellow podcaster, but I describe his show as the anti-amateur traveler. So I'm not always the cheeriest guy about travel, but I didn't think I was sort of the complete Debbie Downer. But I guess because I talk more about the journey, the act of sort of transiting travel as a verb, rather than being a tourist, which you are when you get to your destination, my travel stories are going to sort of naturally follow what I think we all believe is the dramatic decline in that travel experience. Sort of airplanes as flying cattle cars, beat up high mileage rental cars, and don't even get me started on the TSA. I'm actually trying to do this podcast as not saying anything about the TSA. I mean, any podcast whose major characters are, as I said in the said previously, four of the top eight most hated companies in America, you know, I just isn't going to be as upbeat as some. You just can't do it. Now, I have varying degrees of success, I think, in being cheery about my travels. It's it's always easier to be chipper when there's something new in the mix. You know, a new destination, a new air carrier, a new plane. I mean, a couple of podcasts ago, while I talked about flying to Madrid on U.S. Air, I mean, I'll tell you, the U.S. Air Service, and remember, they're one of those, those four top eight most hated companies. I mean, it was definitely a 9-hour drag, but it couldn't dull the excitement of going to a new destination. I'd never been to Madrid before, and even though I was going to spend, 80% of the time in a conference room, I was excited. But this last trip to Phoenix, I mean, going to the same place for the umpteenth time on American, on old MD-80s, by the way, one of which had a 1983 manufactured by date, and which also happened to treat me to yet another 2-hour maintenance delay, and then the temperatures in the hundreds every day, I'll tell you, I just had to absolutely drag myself to the airport. The best thing about that trip, it's sort of a toss-up between the convertible Mustang from Avis and the Tempe In-N-Out Burger, where I killed some of that 2-hour delay. But then again, I mean, who really enjoys their commute to work? I mean, most of the times, that is what my travel is, a commute to work. I mean, some people drive 45 minutes to work. I fly 3 hours. And just like you should avoid road rage while you're commuting, I try to avoid travel rage. I mean, specifically when my commute goes wrong, I do try to limit the collateral damage. I mean, first off, I try not to call anybody. I mean, there's nothing to be gained from talking to family or colleagues live. Oh, I'm going to be late coming home or getting to the office. American, United, Southwest, Joe's cattle car, decided to skip preventive maintenance this month in order to make payroll. And so I'm waiting out a maintenance decision. The delay is going to be either 30 minutes or 3 hours. Depends on whether duct tape can fix the problem. Oh, says my wife or secretary or whomever, that's too bad. I'm sorry to hear that. And I say, not as sorry as I am to be living it. Now, you see, that's just not a good exchange for anyone. I mean, I'm not feeling any better. And worse yet, I've just passed along my frustration, my lousy day, to a completely innocent bystander. Best to just rely on email or text messages. Just make sure you immediately delete the inevitable frowny face emoji icon that, your secretary or significant other sends you. Leaving it fester in your inbox is just going to sort of lead to bad things. The same goes with airline gate agents and hotel clerks. I mean, they didn't overbook the hotel or break the plane. I mean, on a good day, these folks are just barely breaking minimum wage. They're just trying to get to the other side of 8 hours. And unless they're sort of preemptively snotty to me, right, take an attitude before I even open my mouth, I give them a pass too. So we've talked about a lot of people who aren't responsible for botching up my commute. Who is then? I mean, who can I dump this rage on? I mean, that is sort of the challenge, right? I mean, when you're driving down the freeway and a guy cuts you off, you can see the culprit. You can yell, you can glare, you can flip him off, you vent. And then if you're a normal person, you move on. Airlines, hotels, car rentals, you'll never see the person that made your morning miserable. You can't find them to flip them off. They don't even know you exist. They're sitting inside some operations center, combining the output of some linear program that's doing revenue optimization with some weathercast and, sending out emails that are going to completely jack up my day. I mean, it's nothing personal. I'm just collateral damage. Without that outlet, though, that ability to vent directly to the culprit, that frustration just sort of festers. Now, the undisciplined take it out on innocent workers. And I mean, we've all seen that. Guy yelling, turning red, yelling at a gate agent. I mean, the introverts sort of mutter to themselves under their breath. The majority of us, though, I think we just sort of inhale, exhale, and then make for the closest dispensary of the three cure-alls for travel frustration: fat, salt, and beer. Second topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is tablet wars. Apple's iPad 2 versus the Samsung Galaxy Tab 10.1 Android thing. Wow, that was a lot of numbers. Anyhow, regular listeners will know that over the past couple of years, I've migrated to an all-Apple technology kit, the 11-inch MacBook Air, an iPhone 4, an iPad 2. I mean, not, this isn't any sort of religious sort of fanboy thing. The desktop unit that I create this podcast on is a custom-built dual-monitor Windows 7 64-bit rig with three hard drives and a Blu-ray DVD burner. So I'm just fairly agnostic. I mean, you know, for me, for, as a knowledge worker, I mean, technology is my hammer. I just, you know, I'm looking for the right hammer for the right job. Well, attending the Google I/O conference earlier this summer, and I've talked about this in the past couple of episodes, they gave us a Samsung Galaxy tablet with the Honeycomb tablet version of Android. I think Honeycomb translates to version 3.1 for the non-Googleites. And then also a Samsung Chromebook. And so during the summer, I've been carrying both the Google and the Apple kit with me, kind of a significant increase in carry-on weight. But it's the only way I know to truly compare equipment. The only way is you got to use it live in the field. And so I'll compare the tablets on this episode, and then I'll talk about my Chromebook experiences in the next episode. So actually, not only have I been carrying both tablets for business over the past couple of months, I actually took them both with me on vacation to the UK, leaving my MacBook Air at home, which makes it kind of the real pressure test. So to cut to the chase, sort of which do I like better? Honestly, it's a real toss-up, and I was kind of surprised. I thought it would be hands down on the iPad, but for me, it's a real toss-up. Both tablets are really nice pieces of hardware. I mean, the screen sizes are a bit different. The Galaxy has a bit more of sort of a high-def aspect ratio, while I think that iPad's dimensions are a little bit more like a sheet of paper. And the Samsung is, I don't know, maybe a couple of ounces lighter than the iPad, but I'll tell you, in the real world, it's a push. They feel the same, both screens are beautiful, and the response times are great. Now, as you would expect, the iPad has a better selection of apps. I mean, the Android tablet just launched this summer, while, you know, the iPad's been out for over a year. Now, actually, though, when I looked at it, when I sort of pressed down into that, for the apps that I use, the delta isn't as huge as the raw number of apps, that difference between the raw number of apps, iPad versus Honeycomb would suggest. I mean, the apps that I use regularly, Evernote, Kindle, Pandora, Dropbox, Skype, Conqueror's expense reporting app, and of course Angry Birds, they're all available for Android. And now the Evernote app right now is the only tablet specific one, and it's really nice. I think they've done a very nice job with it. Actually, I think it's different, and I think it could be better than the iPad Evernote app. But all the other ones work fine. I think the only sort of missing in action apps that have any real impact on me are for WebEx and GoToMeeting. Because I've just come to think that the tablet form is absolutely the best way to watch these sort of webinar online presentations. And so on the Samsung, I really do miss those apps, WebEx and GoToMeeting. I really miss those not being on the Android platform. Now, the operating system, Apple's iOS versus Google's Android, and sort of the built-in, the accompanying apps that are built-in. I mean, the comparison seems to be less of a better versus worse, and more really of a difference in philosophies and design philosophies. I mean, the Apple experience is pretty much locked down. There's only one place to get the apps. The screen layout is not very customizable. You know, it's a grid. You've got to fit into that grid. There's no independent access to the file system. Now, that's not necessarily bad. I mean, most people actually never really change the default settings on their technology, and there's a lot to be said for not letting users screw things up beyond recovery. I mean, it's valid. It's Apple's point of view. It's their design point of view. It's their aesthetic. It's a valid one, but it does have some impact. I mean, when we were in the UK with only the two tablets, I wanted to replace my Facebook profile picture with one that had been taken that afternoon in the Glengoyne Scotch Distillery near Loch Lomond. I mean, my daughter had taken a picture with my iPhone, plunk it around the Facebook app. I couldn't find a way to change my profile picture. So I emailed the photo from my iPhone to my Gmail account. So logging into the Facebook site on the iPad Safari browser, I couldn't save the picture from the Mail app to a place where the browser could access it. I mean, for security reasons, all the iOS, all the iPhone, iPad apps seem to exist within their own sandbox. But opening up Gmail on the Samsung tablet with the Android system, I could save the picture to the folder of my choice and then upload that picture from that folder to the Facebook site through the Android browser. Now, it's a little thing, and not necessarily all, I mean, it's not earth-shattering, it's not critical, but it illustrates why I found working solely with the Android system when I was without my PC, I found that easier than being without a PC and only having the iPad. I mean, the Android design philosophy is to give the users much greater control over their experience, which means I can spelunk around the file system, I can tweak the technical operations, I could rearrange the screens and drop widgets that give me information, not just give me shortcuts to applications. I can create truly horrid screen designs. And, of course, I can view sort of Flash-based websites to my heart's content. Now, Again, it's a design decision. I found it interesting, though, that my daughter, who's starting high school this year, tends to pick up the Samsung tablet over the iPad. I mean, a lot of that probably has to do with the fact that she's got an Android phone, but she also seemed to just prefer the Google experience, the ability to fudge around with things over the Apple experience. So, I mean, as I said at the top, it is really a toss-up. I mean, I think the iPad is a more polished experience. I mean, it feels 1 to 2 releases ahead of the Android tablet, which, if you look at the timeline, it's been out for a year longer, so it is 1 to 2 releases ahead of the Android tablet. The Samsung tablet, though, I think keeps right up with Apple in hardware and in fit and finish, and Android lets the advanced user customize it better to his or her specific needs. So the final recommendation, at the same price, so all price being the same, I'd recommend the iPad for a casual or sort of non-technical user. But I'll tell you, if you like to pop the hood on your technology, you won't go wrong with the Samsung. Okay, that's it. That's the end of Travel Commons podcast number 92. I hope you all enjoy this podcast, and I hope you decide to stay subscribed. This episode's bridge music is from the CC Mixer website. I haven't used that in a while. If you go to the show notes at travelcommons.com, I will have a list of the artists, the song names, and pointers to the website. Quite honestly, just given the sequence that I'm recording this, I haven't quite picked out which songs I'm gonna put at which bridge places yet. So if you're interested, if you like them, check out the show notes. And as always, if you have a story, thought, comment, gripe, the voice of the traveler, remember the not so upbeat voice of the traveler, send them along, text or audio file to comments, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com, or to mpeacock on Twitter, or write them on the Travel Commons wall on Facebook, or post them on our website at travelcommons.com. Thanks to everyone who's taken the time to send in emails, tweets, post comments on the website. Until we speak again, travel safe. Thanks for stopping by the Travel Commons. Bye now.
Life is hell, strange bed in a lonely motel. But one thing needs my mind, the warm woman that I left behind. From California to Carolina, she calls me up and there's nothing finer. And when the tears start falling, crying into the phone,